Hello, I'm Fully Batibo. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, it's Sri Lanka's worst economic crisis in decades, and it's pushing people to the brink. So what's gone wrong for the island's nation, and can it secure the cash it needs to buy basic supplies? Also this week, China's GDP growth for the first quarter beats forecast, but the country is weighed down by lockdowns. So can Beijing keep the economy growing, or will the world's manufacturer grind to a halt? And as fuel prices rise, electric car makers eye an increase in sales, but is demand for the vehicles really increasing among drivers? And if so, is there enough to supply them? Thank you very much for joining us. Sri Lanka's coffers have all but dried up, and it cannot afford to pay for imports. Millions of its people are bearing the brunt of the country's economic crisis. Basic goods are in short supply, power cuts are frequent, prices are soaring, and the value of incomes is eroding. Many people blame the president for the worst economic crisis in more than 70 years, and they've taken to the streets demanding he step down. Gotabaya Rajapaksa has admitted making mistakes and promises he will correct them. Now, Rajapaksa has appointed a new cabinet, but the opposition has threatened to bring it down. Part of the country's economic crisis is caused by a lack of foreign currency. Sri Lanka's finance minister has started talks with the International Monetary Fund seeking a rapid financing instrument, or RFI. The island nation has also turned to India and China for debt relief, but both countries have offered more credit lines to buy commodities. Sri Lanka has suspended payments on its international debt of more than $51 billion, effectively putting the country in default. The island nation's foreign reserves stood at less than $2 billion at the end of March, while the country's foreign debt obligations for this year exceed $7 billion. The stock exchange was also suspended for 5 days last week. Now, Sri Lanka's inflation rate climbed to almost 19% last month, up from more than 15% in February, its highest level since October 2008, and the fastest rate in Asia. Here's an idea of how much basic necessities now cost. White rice, a common Sri Lankan staple, increased by 93% since 2019. Chicken and lentils have gone up by at least 55 and 117% respectively. The state-owned Ceylon Petroleum Corporation raised the price of fuel by more than 130% last week. And a standard household cylinder of cooking gas increased from almost $5 in 2021 last year to $9 this year. And the country's rupee has plunged to record lows, becoming the world's worst performing currency. The government has devalued the rupee, placed curbs on non-essential imports, and almost doubled interest rates in a bid to tackle the economic crisis. Sri Lanka's economy has lost much of its tourism revenues because of the pandemic, and remittances dried up. But critics say government decisions to cut taxes and shift to organic farming are among the main reasons behind the crisis. Well, joining us now from Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo, is Umesh Muramudali, who's an economics lecturer at the University of Colombo. Thank you so much for being with us on Counting the Cost. This is by far the worst crisis Sri Lanka has faced since independence in 1948. How did we get to this point? What went wrong?
Well, to start with, this government made a series of bad choices, starting from the tax cuts when they elected to the office in 2019. And subsequent to the COVID pandemic hit the globe, that had an adverse impact on Sri Lanka as well. However, the decisions that the government made subsequent to the pandemic, particularly to hold the rupee following a fixed exchange rate regime, particularly the decision not to restructure debt and going to IMF, that is what has actually led to this crisis. Because when we enter into 2021, it was quite clear that there was no way Sri Lanka is going to continue with the foreign debt repayments because the country's foreign reserves were low. Mm. And we lost significant amount of revenue through tourism because of the pandemic impact. And on the other hand, we didn't have the ability to go to the international capital markets and borrow what you call issuing euro bonds or sovereign bonds. That is because of the pandemic and as well as largely the tax cuts.
Right.
So you didn't have the luxury of refinancing, and the ideal option was the debt restructure, and the government decision to not to take that option was what caused this whole crisis today.
President Mahinda Rajapaksa has admitted making mistakes. Is it just down, though, to his policy decisions that have made Sri Lanka's economy so vulnerable to these shocks? Or are there other factors at play?
Well, the economy was vulnerable because Sri Lanka's export hasn't grown probably over the last couple of decades or more. And at the same time, the tax revenue was very, very low, probably one of the lowest among the world. So when you are in such a position, you have to be very cautious when you make economic policy. And they were not cautious. Particularly when you have a very low tax revenue, it doesn't make sense to give tax cuts, right? But they went ahead and gave it as an election promise. And soon after they elected to the power, they went ahead with the tax cuts, which was absolutely unnecessary for a country that has very low tax revenue. So it, and also their decision to strictly, you know, not going to IMF, because they were kept insisting that we are not going to IMF, we are not seeking IMF assistance. And they waited till the last moment when people are dying of shortages to make that decision. So it was the wrong policies that they have pursued, ignoring the economist advice that has led to these shortages and the daily suffering of the people that we are experiencing today.
Well, the government has now officially requested, you know, the IMF's help. Which, you know, has been criticized because, as yourself, many people have said, it's taken too long for them to go to the IMF. They've requested an RFI, which is usually granted to countries with urgent funding needs because of a sharp commodity price rise, for example, or natural disasters. Will they get this? And you know, will the IMF bailout work this time around?
Let's talk about the bailouts in two parts. Firstly, the RFI, what you mentioned, Rapid Finance Instrument, then you will have something what we call the Extended Fund Facility, which is the normal bailout package that the IMF provides, which Sri Lanka got in 2016. But for Rapid Finance Instrument to be received, Sri Lanka's debt has to be at a sustainable level, which is not. The recent staff report by the IMF clearly stipulates that Sri Lanka's debt is unsustainable, and unless the government is in a path to make the debt sustainable, the IMF will not be in a position to provide lending at this point. So it's a bit of a tricky situation. Mm-hmm. It's quite difficult at this point to get an RFI because the level of debt the country has. But we'll have to see what policy actions that the IMF would like Sri Lanka to take at this point, and if that policy actions helps to get an RFI.
What about China and India? They've offered credit lines. Does that offer a lifeline, or will it mean more debt for Sri Lanka?
Well, I mean, there's definitely going to be more debt because that's the only way out of this. You'll have to borrow. What you need to be cautious is at this point, you will have to borrow, but you have to borrow cautiously so that you don't overburden yourself with debt. And also to get a more of a concessionary form of debt, you know, the debt that you have to repay across long number of years, and also with a low interest rate, because we can't really take the burden of a commercial debt anymore at this point, what we are in right now. And also with the credit lines might help in the short term, particularly in terms of fuel supply, which is what we are running on these days. The fuel credit line provided by India. There's another credit line coming from India for medicine, essential food and intermediary goods. Mm-hmm. Chinese embassy in a press conference a few weeks ago mentioned that they are also willing to provide a credit line and another loan. So some of the goods that we will receive through the credit lines, but that's how quickly that those things come is also important, what we call as bridging finance.
Okay. Now, speaking of the debt, the Moody's ratings agency has warned that Sri Lanka will see a series of defaults on its foreign debts after the government said it would stop repayments, of course. What are the implications of that? What would that mean for Sri Lanka and its people?
The way in which we defaulted our debt was not the worst case. Mm-hmm. The reason being in 12th April, we made an announcement called what we call a unilateral default or informing all the creditors that we are not able to pay rather than an abrupt or disorderly default. So that's a one good thing. Mm-hmm. So which means we tell our creditors that, look, here we are willing to restructure your debt and we are going to IMF to have negotiations. So things wouldn't be bad as in a disorderly default. So that's one good thing that was done. But that was the question was whether that was too little, too late. So this all depends on how quickly the debt restructuring process goes, that has to go along with the IMF negotiations as well. So the consequence of it, I wouldn't say it would be very severe.
Okay.
It wouldn't be bad as in a disorderly default. I don't think that the imports will affect due to the default, but the imports are already affected because the reserves are running low. So that's the key concern to address now. Find foreign reserves from somewhere or continue to get credit lines to ensure that the basic supply of food, medicine, fuel, and etc.
I was going to ask you about that, that the choices, the best options now for Sri Lanka's government. Are there ways for the government to improve the country's fiscal position while also protecting those who might face poverty as a result of policies that might lean towards austerity?
There has to be a proper social safety net program, giving cash transfers to those who are particularly affected by the high food prices and shortages, and make it a priority along with these reforms. Because otherwise, these reforms will not be politically feasible because these people will come to the roads and start rioting in response to this. So it requires a clear communication strategy to communicate to the vulnerable groups that this is what we are doing and this is how we are going to protect you, and to do the needful to protect them.
Thank you so much for talking to us about this and shedding light on the situation in Sri Lanka. Umesh Muramudali, lecturer in economics at the University of Colombo. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
China's economy has beaten all expectations for the first 3 months of the year. Gross domestic product grew by 4.8% compared to a year earlier, but consumer spending fell and unemployment rose, suggesting tougher months ahead. That's as the country is expected to feel the full-blown impact of coronavirus lockdowns and the war in Ukraine. Many economists say Beijing's growth target of around 5.5% for 2022 appears to be out of reach. Katrina Yu reports from Beijing.
China's economy beat most expert forecasts and expanded by 4.8% in the first 3 months of 2022. Strong manufacturing activity and a boost in infrastructure spending early in the year drove much of that growth. But major challenges threaten the outlook of the world's second largest economy.
The global situation has been complex and fluid. Domestically, COVID-19 continues to have an impact. That's why some major indicators slowed down, and there's a pressure on economic performance.
China is battling its worst coronavirus outbreak since the beginning of the pandemic, and tens of millions of people nationwide have been confined to their homes. Lockdowns imposed in March across major industrial and commercial hubs, including Shanghai and Shenzhen, have crippled supply chains and assembly lines. Analysts say the damage caused by shutdowns will be further felt in future economic data. But retail spending has already contracted by 3.5%. Unemployment has also risen. Foreign business leaders say Beijing's zero-tolerance approach to COVID-19 is harming both the domestic and global economy.
The West and Japan, Korea, all the big economies have a strong interest that China changes tune, because 30% of all goods in China, manufactured goods, have some sort of China in there. So if China actually sneezes, the world catches a cold. We need China to succeed. We need China to open up in order to actually maintain also the global economy at a certain speed. And the global economy needs China now to succeed, because we have a war in Ukraine, which has a ripple-on effect. And this is like a perfect storm coming out together, unfortunately.
Rising inflation and a cash crunch in the property sector are also dragging on growth.
The government has set a GDP target of around 5.5% this year. It's the lowest in decades, but many believe this figure will be tough to achieve without the rolling out of more aggressive stimulus measures.
Still, China's leaders insist on maintaining the most heavy-handed pandemic measures in the world. The cities of Xi'an, Suzhou and Zhengzhou have joined Shanghai in imposing restrictions following local outbreaks over the weekend.
Well, joining us now is Ruben Mondejar, Professor of Asian Initiatives at the IESE Business School and President of the Asian Studies Association of Hong Kong. Thank you very much, Mr. Mondejar, for being with us on Counting the Cost. Let's start with the good news, the positive news first. The Chinese economy making a solid start to the year. What are the main factors driving this growth?
Well, as you know, they are still benefiting from their success of the Wuhan experience. So while the world was starting to crumble down, China was recovering. So they continued being the world's factory. So they were exporting and they were making the goods that the world demanded. So This is a result of that.
Right. But the first quarter GDP does not tell the whole story, does it? I mean, what's the reality of the situation right now on the ground?
Okay, they said 5.5% is the target for the whole year. Mm-hmm. Personally, I'm doubtful about that. It depends on several things. I would mention three things. The first one is the revival of the domestic consumption within China. The second one is the resumption of international trade, which was disrupted by the Ukraine war. So imports of China has gone down, and also you know that China imports an array of goods which are later re-exported. So both are down because the ports have also begun to be closed. Flights have also been reduced. So that all contributes to downflow of international trade. And the third one is the supply and demand factors. First of all is the Ukraine war. Second is the prices of commodities driven by the war. So you have oil, coal, natural gas, and other commodities, food also. Third is inflation. Mm-hmm. And China's way to tackle it is different from the other countries. But I hope it works. And then production capacity is down because of the lockdowns. And farmers' factories are kind of slow down.
Right. Well, let's talk about those lockdowns. Since the beginning of March, China has struggled to contain its worst COVID-19 outbreak since the start of the pandemic. As you yourself said, when the world was dealing with it, China was actually doing much better than most countries. But now it's in the grips of this crisis. We've seen important ports like Shanghai shut down. How does the government make economic stability a top priority while also maintaining this zero COVID-19 policy strategy?
One solution that China always had was to use infrastructure investment. Mm-hmm. If things are down, they will double down on making more infrastructure. That's to preserve employment, to keep the economy going, because externals will be difficult. So they will use internal tools in order to keep the economy going. But, you know, that's not very easy to do, because there are other issues that they have to contend with. For example, the aging of the population, the cultural factors, the lying down attitude of the population. The positive side is innovation and technology improvement goes up. Mm-hmm. But those are the things that they have to, you know, make sure that they interact properly so that the economy is able to move.
Briefly, Mr. Monnerat, let me ask you about the global impact on this, you know, especially for those countries who rely on Chinese production and on demand for Chinese investment. How difficult do you see the situation being for them in the coming months?
For me, I consider this a very difficult issue because they have a playbook rule to follow because of the this year is special for China. They have this special meeting in which President Xi is expected to have another term, another 5-year term. So that cannot be disturbed. So in the past, once these things happen, so it's very difficult to move because, as we have seen already in the past, beginning the Wuhan crisis, there's a China way of doing things. And that's why in the first stage of the Wuhan crisis, it was like disaster. But they quickly changed. But that change has to be decided by the top.
Okay.
So, and that is the problem here.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for talking to us, Ruben Monnerat. With petrol prices soaring, the preferences of car shoppers are shifting. Drivers are increasingly choosing cars that plug into sockets over those that burn fossil fuels. Global sales of electric vehicles are estimated to have jumped nearly 120% in the first quarter of the year, despite the high costs of the vehicles and batteries. The average cost of lithium-ion battery cells increased to at least $160 per kilowatt hour in the first quarter of this year. That's compared to $105 last year. The higher battery costs added almost $1,500 for the best-selling electric vehicle in China, for example. Supply chain disruptions and sanctions on Russian metals are among the main factors driving up costs. Now, the market share of electric vehicles around the world increased 41 times in the last 10 years, reaching 8.3%, and sales broke records globally last year. Global EV purchases reached more than 6 million units in 2021, 108% more than the previous year. 130,000 electric vehicles were sold throughout the year in 2012. That figure was reached in a week in 2021. China recorded the highest sales at 3.4 million. 2.3 million electric vehicles were sold in Europe. This figure was up by 66% compared to 2020. The U.S. ranked third with 735,000 electric vehicle sales. Well, joining us now from London is Casper Rolls, who's a chief data officer at Benchmark Mineral Intelligence, an agency specialized in electric vehicles and battery supply chain. Casper, thank you so much for being with us on Counting the Cost. So what is driving this demand for electric vehicles? Are environmental concerns motivating buyers, or is it more about gas prices?
There's a combination of factors that are driving electric vehicle demand at the moment. In some regions, it's subsidies. So you're seeing some quite generous subsidies available on electric vehicles, particularly in China and in Europe. In the kind of policy world as well, there's some big drivers. So again, in Europe, there's fleet emission standards that need to be met by automakers across their whole fleet. So one way to achieve those is to move to more and more electric vehicle sales. And then just the kind of longer term as a consumer, looking at the plan to end internal combustion engine vehicle sales at various different dates globally, but between 2030 mm-hmm. and let's say 2050, generally speaking, people are thinking now more and more about electric vehicles. And I guess just finally kind of a consumer preference to move to a more environmentally friendly technology.
Right. Speaking of the longer term, let's talk about the cost, the price of these vehicles, because there's been a continuous surge in prices, right, for electric vehicles. Cost rose because, of supply chain disruptions, the sanctions on Russia, for example. Do you expect this rise to be temporary, or will battery costs, for example, stay elevated, or are we going to see at some point some sort of stabilization?
You know, the major component that's driving the rising cost of batteries is lithium-ion battery critical raw material. So the cathode, there's a cathode and an anode in the battery. Cathode represents over half of the cost of the battery at the moment, and that's where you find the lithium, the nickel, the cobalt, the manganese. And those prices are very high. As you know, high prices will incentivize more investment in production of those raw materials. So we're seeing cash flow into new lithium operations, new nickel operations, etc. But it takes a long time for that material to come to market. It will take many years for new mines to be built. We typically say around 7 years. So we will see those investments that are happening now and commenced last year come into play in the coming years, and that will balance costs. Now, the ultimate cost of the EV, I guess, is really what matters in the conversation today. And there's still economies of scales to be made in terms of at the vehicle production level and at the pack production level. But we do expect these raw material markets to go in and out of deficit over the next decade. So right now, the main problem is lithium, and lithium is in deficit and the market is very tight. And that's why we've seen prices for lithium. Benchmark publishes various different grades of lithium prices, but on a global basis, the average is up 465% year on year. And since the start of the pandemic recovery, it's closer to 800% now.
I was going to ask you how manufacturers are getting around the supply chain disruptions.
I mean, it's very challenging at the moment. I mean, we had the earnings call yesterday from Tesla, who specifically, Elon Musk and the Tesla team specifically mentioned lithium as a major concern and could be a limiting factor in the rate at which lithium-ion batteries can be produced. And they are exposed to costs at the moment. So by that, what I mean is there's no hedging mechanism like you would have in something like other larger commodity markets. These are specialty chemicals, lithium in particular. It's not a commodity. You can't just use any kind of lithium in your process. You have to qualify that product. So it's very, very challenging. So at the moment, what we're seeing is, largely speaking, those additional raw material costs are being added to the cost of the vehicle in some way, or margins are being squeezed.
Casper Rold, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at @FullyBarAJE, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email. countingthecosts@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Fully Batibo. From me and the whole team here in Doha, thanks for watching. The news on Al Jazeera is next.